30 different mosques throughout the entire state of Minnesota so people can just worship in peace. That is not the America, and that is not what Minnesotans believe of peace and protection. This is chaos. This is confusion. And now it is taking the lives of people on the streets, but also we know of people that are being terrorized and many who have died at the hands of federal agents once they're in the detention centers.
I wanted to go to Minneapolis resident Emily Heller, who witnessed the ICE agent shoot Renee Good and told CNN Good did not weaponize her car, as ICE claimed, as Noam claimed.
They seem like children. They seem like untrained people. And so that agent was obviously spooked because he had just killed someone. And it was very obvious to everyone who had witnessed it all that she would not make it. My life is forever changed from having witnessed this. And I just can't let this narrative that it was self-defense go any further, because it's absolutely not what it was.
So City Council Member Robin Wansley, what about the investigation here? Shockingly, the Homeland Security Secretary, instead of saying we'll investigate this, she and President Trump completely contradicted the video. I mean, President Trump saying that Robin Good ran over the ICE agent who shot her at almost point-blank range. We see him walk away, holstering his gun. He says he was hospitalized and barely survived.
Yeah. Again, these are just more blatant lies coming from the Trump administration, because what their ultimate aim is to normalize that. This, they want to set this as the new norm for their operations, be it under Homeland Security, be it through ICE. They want to essentially say that we can circumvent your civil liberties. We can shoot civilians at our own discretion. And guess what? Residents, guess what, U.S. citizens, guess what, general public, you have nothing to say about it. There is no accountability that you can have over us, because we are a federal agency. And this is why it's so important that, as you know, the general public, supporters of the movements and organizing that's happening here in Minneapolis, for you all to help us in raising this banner, raising this call to action amongst the Democratic Party, amongst labor unions, amongst any organization that has said that they are committed to human rights, civil rights, social justice, equity, anything other than that nature, to make sure that there is responsibility, that there is a judicial proceeding, and one that is not led by the Trump administration, an independent investigation and a full, again, judicial proceeding over the federal agents involved in this. Because again, this happening here in Minneapolis sets a tone for this to play out in many other cities, where they can go in and kill civilians without any due process. And that's what we saw. They're rushing, as they did with the federal agent who shot and killed Renee Good in the morning. They immediately removed that agent or the agents involved from the scene and immediately went into public narrative mode. And they're trying to blame the victims, which is what they've been doing with this whole campaign of fear and cruelty. They're blaming regular people. And Edwin framed it so eloquently. These are people who are simply trying to work, people who are trying to make rent, people who are trying to take their kids to school, who participate in our communities. They want others to believe that these are enemies, that these are threats to our collective safety, when the ultimate threat is the Trump administration and their ICE agents that they're sending in to terrorize our communities. And it's up to us to say, no, we will not stand for this. And I am proud of our Minneapolis community that has a demonstrated track record of showing that when one of our neighbors are under attack, when our government institutions aren't protecting our residents and our most vulnerable communities, we will organize on their behalf. We will organize for justice. We will organize for accountability until we see those things be enacted. And we have no shorter expectations in this case in making sure that Renee Good and her family and all the other immigrant communities who have been terrorized and civilians who've been terrorized by ICE agents being in our city until they're held accountable. And if that needs to happen in our own backyard, if it's through their attorney general, if it's through our local state lawmakers, we need to put every proposal on the table to make sure that accountability and justice is delivered for Renee Good, and that ICE agents are sent, they're sent packing out of our city and out of our state. And also at the local level, we need to be exhausting every tool that we have. One of the things that I'm bringing forward in the coming days, as Edwin highlighted, people are afraid to leave their homes, to go to work, to go to school, to go to their places of worship. But in response to that, we're seeing February 1st approach. Rent is still due for thousands of our residents, and they have no ability to make that rent. And no resident should be forced to choose between keeping a roof over their head or having to leave their homes to try to work and risk being kidnapped and abducted, and if not killed by a federal ICE agent. So my office is going to be bringing forward an eviction moratorium, where I hope to earn the support of my fellow colleagues, the mayor, as well as our general public, to make sure that our residents can shelter in place safely and don't have to worry about making rent, having to pay their rent, keeping their roof over their heads and their families' heads. That is the smallest thing of relief that the city can extend to our residents right now who are fearful to leave their homes, and justifiably so, while ICE is here in our communities.
Well, Minneapolis City Council, you've signed a put together a statement calling for ICE to leave the city and the state, as have other local and state officials. Could you explain what kind of authority the city or the state have in determining whether federal agents should be there or not?
I think the authority is the welfare of our residents, the welfare of the people that we've taken an oath to serve and protect. Right now, the welfare of our residents, of the general public, be it here in Minneapolis and all across the state of Minnesota, as Edwin laid out, how this is impacting residents beyond the metro, it's very clear our communities are being destabilized. They're being terrorized by the presence of ICE here. And they are the imminent threat. They are the domestic terrorists right now in our communities that should be removed immediately. And whatever authorities that we can leverage, I don't care if it has to be legally, again, politically, whatever needs to happen. There are elected officials all across the country since Trump took office and decided that he would leverage immigration as his tool of division and as the spear of his campaign for cruelty to distract us from the fact that they are robbing us every chance that they can of our basic needs, of our ability to have a quality of life in this country. Since they've done that, It's important for us to look at the other cities that elected officials have used creative means to make sure that ICE and any of the faces or the extensions of the Trump administration, to make them know that they are not welcome in that city. And we've done some of that. We've said we're passing policies to let you know you can't stage in our public spaces. Maybe we need to ramp up enforcement of that using our own law enforcement to say, if you are here, no, cars will be towed. You will be reminded every chance that you that we can get that you are not welcomed here. You will
seconds.
Be denied
Do
access to bathrooms and all those things.
You have the mayor saying, get the F out of this city. Do you think we'll be seeing Minneapolis police arresting ICE agents?
I think that is the dream. That is a dream. Even with Governor Walz noting that the National Guard is on potential standby, the deployment of the National Guard or any law enforcement agency in our community, if they are being asked to show up in our streets, they should be asked to show up to protect civilians from ICE agents.
Edwin, we give you the last word. We have 10 seconds.
Right now, all I want to say for any listener and viewers is that we're under so much fear, and I am tired of living in fear in a community that I love, in a country that I love. My families are immigrants. We're not criminals, and we just want to live our lives.
Edwin Torres de Santiago, I want to thank you so much for being with us from the Immigrant Defense Network in Minneapolis. And we want to thank Minneapolis City Council member Robin Wansley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Next up, the U.S. has seized two more oil tankers with links to Venezuela days after the U.S. attacked Venezuela and abducted the president. Stay with us. Jackson. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
U.S. forces have seized two more oil tankers with links to Venezuela days after the U.S. attacked Venezuela and abducted President Nicolas Maduro along with his wife. One of the oil tankers was seized in the Caribbean. The other, a Russian-flagged tanker, was intercepted in the North Atlantic. In response, Russia accused the U.S. of violating maritime law, calling for the release of the ship's crew. This comes as the Trump administration has announced plans to control sales of Venezuela's oil indefinitely.
On Wednesday, President Trump told the New York Times in an extended interview the U.S. may run the country for years. Trump also claimed the interim Venezuelan government is, quote, giving us everything that we feel is necessary, unquote. This is Secretary of State Marco Rubio speaking Wednesday.
As you've seen today, two more ships were seized. We are in the midst right now and, in fact, about to execute on a deal to take all the oil. They have oil that is stuck in Venezuela. They can't move it because of our quarantine and because it's sanctioned. We are going to take between 30 and 50 million barrels of oil.
We're joined now by two guests. From Caracas, Venezuela, we're joined by Carlos Ron, former Venezuelan diplomat who served as vice minister for North America from 2018 to last year under the government of Nicolas Maduro, co-coordinator of Nuestra America, office of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. He's joining us from Caracas. His new piece for Counterpunch headlined, "The Current Situation in Venezuela, A Government in Charge, A People Resilient." And we're joined by Francisco Rodriguez, Venezuelan economist, senior research fellow at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, professor of public and international affairs at the University of Denver. He has a piece in the New York Times today, How Machado Lost Her Chance to Lead Venezuela. His recent book, The Collapse of Venezuela, Scorched Earth Politics and Economic Decline, 2012 to 2020. He's a former head of Venezuela's Congressional Budget Office. Welcome you both to Democracy Now!, Francisco Rodriguez. Let's begin with you. Start off by responding to the U.S. bombing of Venezuela, killing, according to Venezuela Now, about 100 people, abducting Maduro and his wife. You say this is unprecedented in U.S. history. Can you respond?
Well, yes. I mean, more than U.S. history, being able to extract a head of state from a country to essentially kidnap that the head of state and take it to another country is something that there are no clear historical precedents of. There are invasions, there are occupations like Panama, like Iraq, where the head of state is ultimately captured. Those are essentially wars where there's a losing side. But this is different. This is a decapitation without regime change. So the political system in Venezuela remains intact. It's just lost its leader. But these political systems have a capacity to adapt to the losses of leadership. Of course, you do have a very different component, which is that it's not just that they lost their leader by chance. It's that the U.S. is threatening the country that if it doesn't play according to its plans, it can do that to the current leader. It can, or it can effectively use its force. The U.S. has leveled a credible threat. And that is the reason that Venezuelan authorities are acquiescing to U.S. demands of control over the country's oil revenues.
Well, you said, Francisco, in another interview that, quote, you found it interesting that the United States had such an easy time capturing Maduro and his wife while they slept. That strongly suggests there was some type of internal collaboration from the Venezuelan forces that were guarding him. Could you elaborate on that? Who do you think was responsible for working with the U.S.?
Well, yes. So there are protocols. Any government, and much more so the Venezuelan government that has been dealing with conspiracies, coup attempts for more than two decades, there are protocols for what you do with a head of state when, for example, you're under military attack. So the idea that you can actually be bombing a city and then catch the president in his bed sleeping at night says that there was a very basic failure, and this opens up a lot of questions. Now, we also know that there are about 100, by the Venezuelan government's account, persons who died during this raid. 32 of them are Cubans, and these are part of the security detail that guarded President Maduro. Now, that to me also suggests, that disproportionate rate of Cuban deaths suggests that something happened in the military where effectively one sector decided that it was going to back this. And then we have essentially less than 48 hours later, the new government saying that it's going to collaborate with the United States. In fact, it first issued a statement, of course, condemning the abduction of Maduro. But on the second day, it issued a statement that could have been issued by any government in the region that actually read more like a statement of a center-right or right-wing government of the region saying we want good relations with the U.S. and we're willing to collaborate. So all of this is the type of pattern. Now, I'm not saying that I have proof of this. I'm just looking at patterns and I'm looking at behaviors, which are very much those that you tend to see when there's a palace coup.
And so, Carlos Ron, if you could respond to this raid and the abduction of former President Maduro and his wife, and also the response, what the response has been in Venezuela. Many have been protesting, calling for his release, but many in exile have been supporting what's happened because they were opposed to Maduro for various reasons.
Well, yes, thank you. You know, first, I think there's still a lot of speculation about, this idea of intrigues, of internal intrigues. But what I see from here on the ground in Venezuela is actually a very, cohesive, display of the Bolivarian Revolution's leadership. I mean, you don't see any fractures. You actually saw every important leader, whether it be political leader, a member of assembly, or military leader, supporting acting president Delcy Rodriguez. But also, ever since the attack, there have been demonstrations by different sectors of Venezuelan society in, like you said, in favor of the releasing of President Maduro, bringing him back home, and in support of the government. Which is actually that is what I think is very atypical in any case of this type of intervention. I mean, this was an act of war by the United States, with no doubt. I don't think this is different from an act of war. I mean, I think this was clearly a violation of the UN Charter. This is a violation of Article 51 and Article 1 and 2. The president of Venezuela is a prisoner of war. Now, I think what is important to see is how Venezuela has, united. This has been something that inside Venezuela has helped, I think, bring Venezuelans together in rejection of this U.S. Attack. You talk about people outside of Venezuela, and these are people that were not, the bombs didn't fly over their heads. I think that you even see that there's even people here in Venezuela that were not members of the government, that were not government supporters, that are people that have, been opposition leaders or militants, You don't see them on the streets, you know, celebrating or doing anything of the sort. You actually see a lot of people that are, you know, frustrated, are angry, and are upset about this incursion from the United States.
I wanted to ask Francisco Rodriguez about the oil, about the seizing most recently of these latest oil tankers, one with a Russian flag, about President Trump saying that the U.S. is going to run Venezuela for the indefinite future, and it'll be funded by taking Venezuela's oil, the latest, the 30 to 50 million barrels of oil that the U.S. will just take, worth something like $2 billion.
Yeah. Well, the details are still unclear as to exactly how it is that this is going to work. Effectively, the Venezuelan economy runs on the revenues from oil sales. Oil is more than 90% of the country's exports. It's around half of its fiscal revenue. This economy does not operate, cannot do very basic things, including even feeding its population, without these oil revenues. Now, President Trump has effectively said that, and his cabinet have said that these funds are going to be deposited in offshore accounts and that the U.S. is going to be deciding how they're going to be spent. But unless they want to cause a famine in Venezuela, this money has to come back to Venezuela to fund Venezuelan imports of essentials, of food, of medicines, of agricultural input, of inputs for restoring the oil sector, its electricity sector. So what seems to be taking place is something that is actually similar to the Iraqi Oil for Food program between 1996 and 2003. At that time, it was the UN Security Council that imposed it, and it was the United Nations as an organization that effectively ran it. What that implied was supervision over how the funds were spent. Of course, in that case, the idea was that the role would be to ensure that they were spent on humanitarian goods, on humanitarian imports. Here, President Trump is being much more explicit that he cares about these imports coming from American companies, so that it's a way to ensure that Venezuela, that the money that comes out of Venezuela is actually spent on contracting the U.S. corporate sector.
Well, Francisco, I want to ask you about something that the New York Times reported in October, which is that the Maduro regime had offered a deal to the U.S. to avoid conflict, which included, quote, opening up all existing and future oil and gold projects to American companies, giving preferential contracts to American businesses, reverse the flow of Venezuelan oil exports from China to the United States, and slashes countries' energy and mining contracts with Chinese, Iranian, and Russian firms. So if that's the case, why do you think Trump refused that deal then, since it seems effectively that's what he's getting now, because that's what he wants?
Exactly. And the answer has to be he wanted to get rid of Maduro. And I think that there were political reasons to get rid of Maduro. Maduro had become essentially the symbol of the Latin American, evil Latin American dictator. That's how he was perceived. Venezuela's current leader, Delcy Rodriguez, is not perceived that way. She's just not known. She's also not linked to allegations of drug trafficking or of crimes against humanity or of political repression to the extent and in the very direct way that Maduro or Diosdado Cabello, for example, were. So I think that the choice was twofold. One of them is to do this, and President Trump actually was clear about this. He offered Maduro a possibility of leaving the country peacefully to essentially go into exile. Maduro rejected it. It's very clear that he wanted Maduro out of the way. And I think also it became a symbolic price. I mean, being able to carry out this operation, extract Maduro, put him behind bars in New York, I think that this is the type of symbolism that President Trump craves and seeks, where he can be seen as a strong and forceful leader whose able to go after after the bad guys or the people who are perceived as being the bad guys.
I want to turn to a clip of Venezuelan President Maduro in an exclusive interview with Spanish journalist Ignacio Omanet just days before Maduro's kidnapping. The interview was filmed December 31st as Maduro drove a car through the streets of Caracas with his wife Celia Flores sitting in the back seat, a red hat with the words "No War, Yes Peace" written in white, also resting in the back seat of the car. During the interview, Maduro said, quote, "The American people should know that here they have a friend, a friendly, peaceful nation, and a friendly government, too." Let's go to the clip.
The far right and the economic threats and blockade campaigns of the U.S. empire, one of the objectives now, the attacks on oil tankers and Venezuelan oil, is to once again disrupt monetary life and the balance that we have already achieved.
Not war, not crazy war.
Yes, peace.
No crazy war. Yes, peace. Yo lo he dicho. Queremos paz.
We want peace. We want respect for international law. And we hope that in the coming weeks and months, the American and global society will be able to generate pressure to end these threats.
So I wanted to get Carlos Ron to respond to that. And also, why President Trump's chose to stick with the government that you were a part of, of course, the Maduro government, Delcy Rodriguez, part of a revolutionary family, her brother, head of the National Assembly, her father, well-known assassinated revolutionary leader, and not go with Maria Corina Machado. And I'd like to get Francisco Rodriguez's response to that as well. You just wrote a piece in The Times about this today, but start with Carlos.
Well, just to clarify, I am not a member of the government. I'm a researcher for Tricontinental Institute. I was a diplomat at some point, but I do support President Maduro, and I do support Acting President Delcy Rodriguez. And I think the reason, what President Maduro said in that clip that you just mentioned was important. You know, the position of the Venezuelan government has always been to try to, you know, get the U.S. to return to diplomacy. I mean, the U.S. got into this mess in the first place by this maximum pressure campaign, imposing sanctions. I mean, that was what really drove Venezuela, you know, apart from U.S. because, you know, just a few years ago, even during President Chavez, the U.S. was a main trading partner for Venezuela. The relations, even though there was, you know, of course, different political and ideological views, there was a different type of relations. Now, I think President Maduro's message there has been the consistent message of President Maduro throughout this time. And I think it still is the consistent message now, you know, peace is something important. Diplomacy is something important. And Venezuela is willing to do that under a framework of respect. You know, that was what Venezuela always sought at that moment. I think that the realization also that there is popular support. I mean, you have to understand that for 26 years, there has been a buildup of popular support for the Bolivarian process. This has been a process that has, you know, improved the quality of life of people. It was a process that had remarkable humanitarian gains up until the sanctions regime started to be implemented and hurt Venezuelan economy and hurt Venezuela's possibilities. But even then, there were a lot of things that were put into place by the Venezuelan government.
We only have 30 seconds, and so I wanted to ask Francisco Rodriguez if you could just quickly respond on basically Trump dumping Machado, the Nobel Peace winner.
Oh, I think Machado could not lead that country. I mean, I think that Trump took a decision that he wasn't going to get into state building. He wasn't going to militarily occupy the country with U.S. troops. So you have to work with existing state structures. Perhaps another opposition politician could have entered into a power-sharing agreement. But Machado, no, she's rejected this. Her politics is a politics of moral absolutism. For her, she said this repeatedly. It's a battle
between
good and evil.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we're going to do an interview in Spanish. Venezuelan economist Francisco Rodriguez and Carlos Ron, thank you so much for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman with Ramin Sheikh.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Do you know what your local wetland has done for you lately? Wetlands function like nature's kidneys, mitigating the impacts of floods and droughts, protecting our communities, and supporting food production. Despite representing 6% of the Earth's surface, wetlands store 33% of the planet's carbon. If you value life, thank a wetland. Learn about wetlands at work with Ducks Unlimited Canada at ducks.ca/wetlands.